nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
In this presentation, I would like to talk about alloy disorder in bulk. And what I want to pose here is sort of a question or a riddle. So if we have one atom pair and we consider it a unit cell and then we put it into an infinite periodic system, we know how to compute band structure. So typically you would compute the band structure on a single repeated unit cell and you assume that nothing happens in its environment and it's going to be infinitely periodic, and that gives you band structure. That's the formal definition of band structure, to figure out what are the states in the system in an infinitely periodic system. That means it's an infinite crystal and there's no fluctuation whatsoever. So if we do that, then we know how to compute gallium arsenide or indium arsenide dispersions for many materials. Right? This is sort of what we understand. But we also know, right, quote unquote know, that alloys such as indium gallium arsenide or aluminum gallium arsenide or silicon germanium, they do have band gaps, effective masses, they have band structure. But they're not ordered. They're not infinitely periodic. There's a conceptual problem. Okay? It's not quite clear how to properly calculate a system that is really disordered and have a concept of band structure, which is based on an ordered system. And to me, fundamentally, the question is, on the nanometer scale, when you start to cut these things down, right, and you pack an alloy into a small geometry, how big do you have to make your system that it almost is bulk-like, or when is it looking like a local thing that is completely determined by local properties rather than looking bulk-like? Because I don't care so much about bulk materials, right? I want to use these kind of materials on a small nanometer scale, and I want to figure out how important are the details of that. Here, in that sense, what does it mean to have a disordered cell? So we know how to compute things in a periodic structure like this, and what I'm plotting here is an aluminum gallium arsenide a random cell, and I'm showing you different incarnations of the same aluminum concentration. Okay? But as you see in this animation, they all look rather different. They are fluctuating, right? They're not ordered. So the question now, in a sense, needs to be, how big do you need to make such a disordered system that you don't see the local order anymore? Right? And if you did that, is all the physics covered? And how does the disorder matter? So this is typically being done in material science with a supercell calculation. And what does that mean? So you take a cell, one sample, and then you repeat it infinitely in all three directions. And then you calculate the eigenstates of this huge system really out of that central cell that is infinitely periodic when you try to come up with conclusions. So let's do that. But before we do that, we have to realize that we have a little bit of a problem. Say we do this for silicon, just for argument's sake, and we calculate a band structure in a tiny cell, even tinier than what I'm showing on the bottom left, we would have the conduction band edge that looks like this, right? There's a gamma point, here's an X point, and we understand that in silicon. So if we double the unit cell, we fold the band structure in half. We would get the green line instead of the red line. Those would be the eigenvalues of our doubled unit cell. If we double the cell again, we would fold the bands again. and we double it again, we fold it again. You know where I'm going with this, right? At the end, we might have a very big cell where K, the original translational K that we used as a description of a single cell, is no longer evident. All we get is a set of eigenstates that are sitting on this axis. And from numerical purposes, we may not be even guaranteed to catch all of these eigenstates. And somehow we have to find a way to unfold this. Unless we are just interested in to find the bottom, right? Which is fine too. If we just want to have the bottom of the conduction band, we can pick that out. If we found just the ground state here in this axis, that's fine. And for many purposes, that's fine. But sometimes you like to get the effective mass, which means you need to have a couple of states over to get the derivative of this. All right. So we developed a methodology to do that, to unfold from eigenstates that are just computed here at k equal to zero to get back the whole dispersion. And I'm not going to tell you all the details of the math, but show you that it can be done. So we get back the whole dispersion. But we can now do this also in a sense where we might consider systems where there's actually fluctuations in there. So it's not just the ideal system, but maybe there's some disorder in there. That would mean there's some disorder on this dispersion, some sort of error margin, error bar. And the height of that error bar would give us an idea about the fluctuations in the system. So we did that, for example, here in aluminum gallium arsenide, and he has shown a 60% aluminum gallium arsenide case. And what we did here is extract the or unfolded the band edges in a cell that has 1,000 atoms in it, and we compare that to something that's called VCA. It's so-called the virtual crystal approximation. To me, that's sort of the poor man's way to do an alloy. What VCA does, it assumes that I can't handle the disorder of aluminum and gallium, but so I'm going to average the parameters that I'm describing aluminum and gallium with, and I create a new atom. I call it aluminum gallium. So I homogenize the whole system by the parameters derived from aluminum and gallium. That's a very common practice, and it's called virtual crystal approximation. So you average the material properties of equivalent or participating atoms, and you create, so to speak, a new atom. You call it the virtual crystal approximation atom. And if you do that, you find you roughly get the same dispersions, except here at the gamma point, you're getting the wrong gap by some, looks like roughly 20, 30 millielectron volt, which could be significant depending on your application. So here, given this methodology, we can actually start to extract effective masses, for example, here at the gamma point, and we can plot those masses out of our unit cell calculation, and we roughly overlap a linear dependence of the effective mass that points starts out at 0.067 as a function of aluminum concentration and goes up linearly. So those results sort of make sense. This is sort of a benchmark to see whether we're doing this right. We can now also look at the band edges that we obtain. So here in the solid line are two experimental data sets where people have measured the band gap of aluminum gallium arsenide as a function of aluminum concentration. And in the previous lectures, I mentioned that gallium arsenide is direct and has an X point that is up in energy, and that aluminum arsenide is indirect. It is, has its minimum at X, and its gamma point is way up in energy. And at some point they cross, and that crossing point is roughly at 40%. That means In RTD-like devices, people only go ever up in aluminum concentration up to 40%, because going up any higher doesn't really increase your gap anymore that is being seen. So there's a crossover. If we now do our random alloy calculation, we basically overlap this reasonably nicely. If we did this in a virtual crystal approximation, where we just average the material properties, at gamma, we would be very wrong. So here, we really would be getting the wrong trend in virtual crystal approximations, which is really where we want to work in less than 40%. Okay? So now, if we do a supercell calculation, we can basically overlap experiment and very nicely. If we did this virtual crystal approximation, we don't get the gap quite right. The gap is too large. And we can now also compute these fluctuations due to aluminum placements. That would be configuration noise. Configuration noise would be taking this exact same concentration, say in a cell of 200 atoms, and you say you want to have a 0.2 aluminum concentration, that means you have to have 20 aluminum atoms and 80 gallium atoms. And you always choose 20 and 80. But you randomly distribute them, but exactly 20 and 80. That would be configuration noise, right? Because you configure the atoms slightly differently. But in reality, when you grow this stuff, chances are you're not going to hit exactly 20 and 80. Right? There will be a statistical fluctuation around that. That would be concentration noise. Because the concentration would have noise on it. And we're going to start looking at the differences between those now. There's a third one, which could be position noise. And why would that be? Here, and this is not relevant in aluminum gallium arsenide. In aluminum arsenide and gallium arsenide are virtually on exactly the same strain, lattice constant, right? So there is no strain. So the atoms wouldn't move out of place due to strain. So they don't have noise on their positions. But in indium gallium arsenide, the lattice constants are rather different. They would actually move out of place. So you would have positional noise as well. Okay? So let's move through that and ask ourselves, how important are these fluctuations and how do they depend on system size? So here, what I've done is calculated 3,000 atom systems, 2,800 samples, and we started to look at the configuration noise only. So we locked in place 20% of aluminum and have a sigma of zero in that concentration. And we find a nicely homogeneous distribution of histogram of conduction band edges. Okay? For each sample, we bin them up and get a histogram and find a nice band gap of roughly 0.56. And it looks symmetric in the conduction band. The valence band has a slight slant to it, and it's not perfectly symmetric. And if I now look at the difference for each sample in the conduction and the valence band, and here I have a gap. So here I have a statistical fluctuation around the gap. So now you can see that the noise of 0.7 and 0.5 don't quite add. Okay, so the width of this curve in the middle and the width of this curve on the left don't quite add to the left, the width of that curve on the right. So that is sort of an indication that the two are not correlated. Okay, and if you plot it in these dots here, for each of these 3,000 samples, so you see 3,000 dots here, you plotted the valence band edge and the conduction band edge, you get a round distribution. Right? That means they're not correlated. You couldn't lay a straight line through this here anywhere where you say, okay, if the conduction band goes down, the valence band goes up or something like that. There's no rule. Okay? So it looks like the configuration noise is uncorrelated. But now we can do the next experiment where we say we can, instead of having a delta function at exactly 0.2 of the concentration, we can allow it to have some fluctuation. We just roll the dice. We'd like to aim for 0.2, but we roll the dice. And for 3,000 atoms or so, you get a certain distribution, and that sigma is 0.011. So it's not significant, right? So we aim for 0.2, and we get somewhere between 0.21 and 0.19. Right? It's not a tremendously large distribution. And what we get is now a distribution of valence bands and conduction bands and gaps that is much, much broader than the distribution we had here. So the blue lines, the blue histograms from the top row are now translated into the middle row here in the blue. And in red, we now have this concentration noise in there as well. Okay? So if you're not having tight control on the concentration and the exact number of atoms that you have, so not exactly 20 atoms and 80 atoms of aluminum and gallium, and you can lock that into place to be 20%, you will have noise, right? You will have 19 and 81 or whatever, right? If that's the case, your bulk band edge is going to have a bigger fluctuation. And if you plot this in a correlated plot, where for each of the dots, for each of the samples, you come up with a dot of the valence band and the conduction band, you find a nice straight line. So that means that the concentration noise is correlated. That means here, if the conduction band goes up, the valence band goes down, right? That means if the conduction band goes up, the valence band goes down, the band gaps get larger or lower, depending on what the concentration is. The band gap goes up and down. Okay, it's correlated. That's nice. It's kind of intuitive. But within each concentration, it's uncorrelated. So the configuration matters. So the last example we can do is explore what happens if you make your system too small. If you don't have a system that consists of 3,000 atoms, but you now take a system that has only 140 atoms, your supercell that has only 140 atoms. That means you really sample different concentrations if you have disorder, right? Because you have no samples in between, because it's a finite number of atoms, right? You can't achieve any old concentration, right? It's a discretized way. If you then do that, your histograms look rather spiky. And again, you can imagine that this is correlated, and indeed it is, right? Uncorrelated in the configuration, correlated in the concentration. And when the system is too large, you can almost see these little bubbles in blue being correlated on along this line. Okay? The bottom line of that is, if you have small systems, the exact concentration, the exact number of atoms that you have in your nanosystems, in your alloy, is going to matter. And that your band edges will move accordingly. And it's a statistical process. That means you have to be cautious when you have systems that have a few atoms thick in one dimension, the details will matter. Even from this bulk calculation, from this numerical experiment, you can derive that or get that insight. All right. So we can now put this on this chart and look at this configuration noise and look at the actual placement of the aluminum atoms in the 3D domain. So we have noise around here, and let's plot this. So the configuration noise alone, so we have exactly 1,000 atoms and we have exactly the right concentration, then we get the valence band moves like this, and the conduction band moves like this. So it has an interesting spike at 40% of aluminum. That is where gamma and x are crossing, if I now allow the aluminum concentration to vary statistically as well, the valence band looks like this before, but the fluctuations are much larger as indicated. And the conduction band edge also fluctuates much more, but once it is becoming indirect, it fluctuates less. So at this crossover of roughly 0.4, the fluctuations die down. So also, the interaction between the bands is what's important. And different bands are differently sensitive to fluctuations. So the points at X appear to be weaker dependent on the details of the concentrations than at gamma. Okay. So I'm ramping down this on a presentation on how large would you have to make a system for these fluctuations to go away. So now let's look at how large do you make that system to have the configuration noise to go away. So again, we set the concentration to exactly one value, and we trace and make this the expectation value of the valence band and the conduction band edge as a function of atoms in the system. So we make the individual supercell bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So we start from roughly 100 to where we did our analysis to 1,000, then to 10,000, and then 1,000,000. So here you see in solid line the expectation values, and in dashed lines the 1 sigma lines around it. And the interesting thing is for the conduction band, it's even non-monotonic. It goes up and it goes down. Here's the sigma plotted as a function of number of atoms, so it gets much smaller, which obeys with the law of large numbers, which makes sense. Right? You want this to go down with the law of large numbers. Now if you do the same thing, but you allow for concentration noise, we now already know that the concentration noise is much larger, so the fluctuations are much larger, and it doesn't show this non-monotonic behavior. And here again, the noise, if you just plot the noise, you see it's 2 orders of magnitude larger ballpark, or an order and a half magnitude larger than the configuration noise. So again, concentration noise dominates. Finally, there's something called clustering. And clustering can be explained roughly like this, where it's not clear that you have a homogeneous alloy. But you could assume that you have some local clusters of aluminum arsenide and then gallium arsenide rather than a complete homogeneous system. And the simple, stupid way to do this in NeMo 3D is to say, I construct my geometry unit cell by unit cell. Okay? So I have an 8-atom unit cell and another 8-atom, so I stack my system together like Legos. And that's the case, I can throw the dice for inside a unit cell and say, okay, I'm going to throw the dice for every aluminum and gallium atom individually. You could be aluminum, you could be gallium. You could be aluminum and gallium. Or I can throw the dice once for the whole unit cell. So then I would have a whole unit cell of 8 atoms to be gallium arsenide. And then in the next cell, I might have an aluminum arsenide cell. And in the next cell, I'm just going to have a gallium arsenide cell again, depending on the choices. But that would give me sort of cubic chunks that are a little bit more clustered, rather than rolling the dice for every aluminum gallium atom. If I do that, my band gap changes, my valence band moves up, and the conduction band moves also up a little bit, but the valence band moves up harder, sharper. And that basically means the gap gets slightly smaller. And the noise is getting a little bit larger, which makes sense because the local arrangements are much more noisy and you need to go to larger systems to have effectively the same system. And the fact that the gap goes down a little bit is kind of commensurate with what it was seen in low temperature growth of algal structures where you have clustering and the gaps do indeed go down. So trying to answer this question on disorder in bulk band structure, how large is large enough? we have this dependence on the system size, and it may be non-monotonic, even with the clustering. So I would argue that once your band edge moves for less than a few millielectron volt, then you're reaching bulk. So my personal claim would be you have reached bulk in roughly 100,000 atoms. That's a pretty big chunk size. Because before that here, in less atoms, you actually have non-monotonic behavior. It's not even clear that you're predicting the right trends if you make the system slightly larger. Now be aware that most ab initio calculations stop at 100 atoms. So look at this noise that you have on here, right? There's 150 millielectron volt noise that is given in this kind of calculation. That noise is due to concentration disorder, configuration disorder, clustering, right? It's not clear of what the right answer really is. So if somebody does an alloy calculation for you in a DFT or an ab initio calculation and they give you one value, you've got to be really suspicious. You've got to ask for, all right, give me different configurations. How big of a system did you compute? How do you really trust that number? Okay? So, the conclusions are that you have band edges and band gaps that are influenced by placement or configuration disorder. You might have concentration noise, and you can have clustering. Note that the system size is very important. To me, bulk starts at around 100,000 atoms. That means nanostructures are not bulk. And quantum dots, nanowires, and quantum wells that have dimensions that are much smaller than the 12 nanometers, which correspond to a chunk of 100,000 atoms, are going to be sensitive to the local order of these atoms. Okay? Yeah?
How did you choose the distribution on your...
I didn't, just throw dice.
No, the distribution of configuration noise and...
I didn't choose it. I ran 3,000 samples, and then I measure what the concentration was in actuality, and I plot a histogram of what the concentration was. And what I'm showing is that if you do that for an ever-increasing number of atoms in your system, that that noise obeys the law of large numbers. It goes down as order square root of n, which you expect. So it's a straight line on a log scale. Okay? So it's statistical sampling. That's it. I don't impose a distribution. And since it's pretty smooth, we sort of stopped at samples of 3,000. I'm sure you can drive that further. I'd like to point out we did 3,000 calculations for a quantum dot or bulk system containing a million atoms or something, right? That's a lot of compute power to do, right? And I mean, each data point is quite expensive, too. Yes?
What about the silicon germanium? Is it available for implicator binding?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I don't understand. Here also a random order is used.
So, there's two ways of doing it. In the VCA approach, the virtual crystal approximation, averages out the material properties, and you end up with a smooth material, right?
But
Nearest neighbor tight binding. That's what we do.
Yeah, because I was thinking that it would make no much sense making a second neighbor with second germanium. Because
you are keeping some weight
parameters.
Yeah, that's the
direction that does not exist in your material.
Right. So you hit exactly to the core why I'm trying to pursue nearest neighbor tight binding. I mean, the fundamental issue is that if you think about it for a while, so let's say we want to do a heterostructure, right? So gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide here, right? And if you have a model that depends on second nearest neighbors, right? So you got to do two neighbors out. That means you have to have a parameterization for different interfaces, for different neighbors all the time. Versus if it's pairwise, it's relatively easy, right? So in a nanostructure that could have almost arbitrary configurations and strain disorder or interface disorder or a rounded quantum dot shapes, I mean, you would have to parameterize a second or third nearest neighbor model for any of these different geometries and shapes. That sort of violates my kind of thinking on there's materials, I don't mess with them. There's a basis description, I don't mess with them. I take my Legos, I assemble these atoms, I put them together in a nanostructure from geometry aspects, and now I'm going to turn my code loose and I'm going to get transport or electronic structure, but I don't muck with the materials. That is in stark contrast how many material scientists do their work. They say, well, I don't know exactly what my base is going to have to be. I'm going to have to add plane waves all the time to figure out whether I have enough plane waves. So for anything they do in terms of their electronic structure calculation, they have to be an absolute expert in what they do. And they do numerical experiments all the time, whether they added enough plane waves or their cutoff was long enough and whether they included exchange or not, right? It's always a new hero experiment. But I like to get to the point where, at least for the semiconductors I'm interested in, I don't have to do these hero experiments all the time, right? I get my Lego box, I assemble these atoms, and I get my device, and I do transport. That's why I don't like second nearest neighbor models, because I feel I'm getting to the realm of I have to reparameterize everything because now my interface has changed or my neighbors changed and all that.
What's the question related to this point? The valid source field has a second neighbor term. The Van Langen term, it is a free center term. And usually for the arm, it's an average of the length of the parameter from the bond angle. Strength is taken, and this is somehow.
I don't think.
UFS, I say it's just an average between the parameters of two pure materials.
I don't think the VFF we use has second nearest neighbor in it.
No, I see the bond angle term.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah, bond distance.
Oh, I see. Because you have actually three partners in that angle.
And indium, nitrogen.
Yeah, but the pair-to-pair is still there, right? But I guess the alpha that and beta that you have in the angular dependence, I guess we must be doing a linear average for the angle then.
Yeah, like it's usually from literature.
Yeah, that's right.
You can make some messes about this one.
Or anything can make a mess. So you have to really calibrate slowly and carefully.
It's a big branch of correction about WFF now, and read a lot of stuff about these exotic correction and stuff like this. I think when you put an average on the beta, it's not, I think that probably it's the same without doing this a lot of huge corrections. So.
Well, I mean, I guess off the record, let me stop my recording here.